Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. We have a great guest today, and before I talk about him, I just want to make sure to remind people to like and subscribe to this podcast, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening to on your podcast feeder. Please do that. That way more people find out about it. We have a great guest today, Kevin Wells. Kevin Wells is a former Major League Baseball writer, award-winning journalist, and the best-selling author of The Priests We Need to Save the Church. He is a freelance writer and an active evangelist who speaks on various Catholic topics. He is the president of the Monsignor Thomas Wells Society, which is dedicated to the promotion of strong priests and seminarians and to the practice of the fullness of the Catholic faith. And his most recent book, and I'll put it up here, is Priest and Beggar, The Heroic Life of Venerable Aloysius Schwartz. Welcome, Kevin. Thanks for coming on.
Eric, it's awesome to be with you. Thanks for inviting me in.
Okay, so I have to ask, and I want to tell everybody who knows me, I will not go super into baseball here, but I do want to ask, how did a former Major League Baseball writer turn into a writer of Catholic books and founder of a Catholic society and speaking on Catholic topics? How'd that transition happen?
Eric, do you mean there's not a lot of people like me?
I don't think so. I mean, that's my dream would have been to write for Major League Baseball and then transition to Catholic stuff or vice versa. I'm not sure. So I want to know how you're living the dream here.
that's like a different, entirely different podcast. But I'll tell you what, I'll try and make it short. It was always my goal to become really a Major League Baseball writer. So I played baseball. There's six Wells boys. We all played baseball and that's our game. And I like to write. So, you know, I wanted to bring the two together and my goodness, it worked out. I moved from Maryland to Florida and all of a sudden Major League Baseball awards a franchise to Tampa Bay. And I told the editor, hey, look, man, I want to be your first ever beat writer. I'm going to work for that job. And I had like 2.5 years to earn it because I think they awarded the franchise in 95 and they didn't have their first game until 98. So I actually ended up becoming the first beat writer. So what happened was, here's what happened, Eric, there's always a story behind it. My wife and I got married in the first off season after the 98 season. Life's good. We went to have our family of 10. She's a Catholic. I'm a Catholic. We wanted a big family. I'm from a family of 10. And we found out we could have no children. God didn't bless us that way. So horrible. I mean, you can just imagine. It's like a guillotine to your marriage. So I'm from an enormous family in Maryland. And at this point, I had already been down in Florida for 7 years. So I hung out for a while longer. And finally, I'm like, you know what, if we're going to start a family eventually, we don't want to start down here in Florida, want to start up in Maryland. So I uprooted and joined the family business. And I said, you know what, I also still want to write. Family business was commercial masonry contracting. But I kept writing as well. And I tended less on the sports and more on the Catholic angle. And that's kind of how it happened.
Okay, great. I have to ask, were you still in Tampa in 2008 when they went to the World Series?
No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't then. I mean, I remember the World Series very well.
Right. But you had already left the job at that point.
Yeah.
Okay. I used to live down in the Tampa area, so I'm a Rays fan as well. So I kind of remember that as well. So let's transition away from baseball. Everybody's breathing a sigh of relief right now. So your most recent book is, like I said, Priest and Beggar, The Heroic Life of Venerable Aloysius Schwartz. Now, tell us a little bit about, what should we call him, Venerable Al? I mean, in your book, I think you call him Father Al and different things. What do you think we should call him during this podcast?
Let's call him Father Al.
Father Al. Okay, Father Al. So that's good, because Venerable doesn't always roll off the tongue that great, unless it's Venerable Bede. So Father Al, now, he was born in your area of the country. So why don't you tell us a little bit about his birth, his upbringing, and just for people who are watching and listening, what we're going to talk about is the life of Father Al, but we also want to tie it into what it means to be a priest. That's going to be a topic that's going to be the thread that goes throughout this discussion, is what it means to be a priest. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about Father Al and his upbringing and kind of what led him to become a priest?
Well, I think I'll start by just saying I think that his Father Al's life is very important for these times, and I hope that priests take his life very seriously, and that this book becomes available to them. Very important man for these times. But Father Al was born in the teeth of the Great Depression in 1930. You couldn't have been born at a worse time. Hitler was on his rise. The dust storms happened. I think 15 million Americans had lost their job that year. And Father Al was born. So his dad was a high school. No, not a high school. His dad was a grade school dropout because his own dad needed him to work in a fish market. So it wasn't looking good for the Schwartz family. And big family of nine, Catholic family of nine. And they knew poverty. And Al understood, Father Al, we'll just call him Al. Al understood very early on at the age of 7 or 8 what poverty felt like. And it seemed like God's face had turned away from the Schwartz family. But very boldly, very, very remarkably, I would say, for a young kid, he said, this is the desolation that Christ felt. Rather than sort of fall into the morass of the Depression and people being thrown off and thrown out of their houses into the alleyways, I need to have trust now. I need to have faith that somehow, although God's face seems turned away from our family, that he's with us. And it was then at the age of 7 or 8 that he said, I want to become a priest and I want to go and serve people that feel like our family, people that are impoverished.
What I think is amazing is one of the most common popular stories in America is the person who grows up poor and then he pulls himself up by his bootstraps and he ends up becoming a successful rich person. And that's the American dream, to go from poverty to riches, material riches. But it's like Father Al turns that on its head because he grows up poor, but it doesn't seem like his idea is, okay, let's try to abandon poverty, but instead he embraces it in some weird way. And it just seems like, you know, it just seems very un-American. I mean, to be honest, because that's the worst thing to have in America is to be poor. Yet Father Al, that wasn't the case with him.
Or saints are radical. Saints beat to their own drum. They don't make any sense to the world. So you're right, Eric, you're right. Father Al made no sense to people. Matter of fact, so at a point in his life, he was 13 years old and his father used to drive the family in their beat up Studebaker over to Sister Malfreda's convent in the poor area of DC in Anacostia, an area that was all black. It still is to this day. And Sister Malfreda was Father Al's dad's sister. So they'd go there about once a month, and right away, Sister Malfreda saw in Al something very special, something very holy, and this friendship formed, this spiritual friendship formed. And this shows you Al's uncommonality with the rest of the world. So as all his brothers and sisters are running around and eating from the treats that Sister Malfreda and the other sisters laid out for him and playing in the yard, after a while, Father Al said, as a 13-year-old boy, she's a phony. This is phony. He didn't tell anyone out loud, but he wrote it in his journals. That's a great thing about a biographer. Somehow they get the journals. Yeah. So what he said was, although she gives her life over to the all black community and teaches them, catechizes them, loves them, brings them in, and she's very beautiful for that, it's phony because at the end of the day, this community see her go back with her other sisters into their convent that had AC, it had radios, it had mirrors on the wall. It's phony because although this community understands that they love them, at the end of the day, they're comfortable. And until she becomes poor and lives poor like them, they'll never truly embrace her.
I'll admit, when I read that section, and for those who are watching or listening, I read the whole book. It's excellent. I recommend it highly. When I read that part, I did feel a little bit like he was being unfair to his aunt. I mean, how many of us go as far as his aunt did? I mean, it's not, yes, okay, her house and where she lived was more comfortable than those around her, but she did go in every day into the poor areas. And it, I think it's what you said about Saints are radical, that they just make us uncomfortable. Even going like his aunt did, 90% wasn't enough for him.
Well, it's this simple. Father Al wanted to be Damien the Leper. He wanted to be John the Baptist. Damien the Leper used to hear confessions in a little box and leave to vomit because of the smell of the disease and come back in and hear more confessions. John the Baptist lived in absolute isolation and poverty. And that's what Al wanted. Again, he was radically different from anyone else. So you're right. Eric, I'm with you. So in reading about Sister Malfreda and what Father Al felt, I was like, yeah, this is unfair how he's treating her. But then again, I think about Matthew 7, when one day I die and I'm sitting across from Jesus and I'm like, hey, Jesus, I tried to treat my wife, Krista, well, and I raised my kids the way I thought I should. And I worked pretty hard. And then Jesus says, no, you know, leave. I don't know you. Depart from me. So I think Father Al had a dimension built into him where he couldn't serve three quarters. He had to serve 100%. I know it's radical. I know it's out there, but that's what lived in him as an icon.
Right. And of course, he's 13 writing his journal. He's going to be blunt. He's not going to try to mitigate how he says it or anything like that. But I did remember that striking me. Now, again, we're going to talk a little bit later in the podcast about how this applies to his life applies to priests today and seminarians. But so I want to talk about his life as a seminarian. It wasn't simple. It wasn't easy. And it's not like as a seminarian, it was just straight through. Okay, you take your 4 years, your 8 years, whatever. So tell us a little bit about how he went from joining the seminary and then eventually that time before he became a priest, because there's a number of hurdles that he went over, I guess, to get to that point.
Yeah, and I'm going to dig that word back up again. I hate to dig it up, but he used it, phony. After 4 years of minor seminary in Baltimore at St. Charles, he ended up with the Mary Knollers, who were the king of the hill, and still are to a certain degree back then. And they were the king of the hill missionaries. At this point, he realized he wanted to be a missionary. He wanted to go to the margins. He wanted to serve the poorest of the poor in a foreign land. And he realized with the Mary Knollers, as they were forming him, that although the Mary Knoll missionaries would go out to Korea and Japan and Africa, again, they would come home at night and they'd have three squares. You know, they'd have a TV on the walls, radios, mirrors on the walls, you know. He just said, that's phony. And I guess the best way to put it, Eric, for the viewer is, He did want to be, and he told the sisters this, and he told people this that would listen. He wanted to resemble Jesus, the starved man on the cross, who bled out, who gave all to redeem all of humanity. Obviously, Father Al in persona Christi could do it to a certain extent, but he knew there had to be a cost, and it was always a choice. And the choice was always, what can I do to most resemble the poverty of Christ? How can I give all? Like Christ asked the rich young man who couldn't give all and he turned away sad. Well, Al said, no. I will follow you all the way to the best that I can. And whenever something strikes me as comfortable or a half measure or maybe sort of an ingratiation of just myself, I will walk away and do the harder thing. He always made the choice to do the harder thing. So at the Mary Knollers, he determined, I can't do this. And he became the first Mary Knoll in formation ever in the history of the country, America, to leave. And he took off for a different order.
And so now he goes over to Europe, and I can't even remember the name of the order now that he went to. So tell us about then. So he's, well, first of all, just, I do think I want to emphasize again, let me take a step back. So for Father Al, it wasn't enough to serve the poor. He wanted to be poor. And I think that that's tough for us to understand, because what's the difference between a guy who goes out and maybe he goes out into the community, he helps people, he takes care, you know, he ministers to them, does all that stuff, goes home, sleeps in a comfortable bed, and a priest who goes out and maybe does the exact same thing during the day, but then he comes home and sleeps in a shack or sleeps in some poverty. It can be hard for us to understand the difference between those two things. And I do want to say, it's not saying the first one is bad or wrong. Obviously, they're doing way better than most of us. But for Father Al, it just wasn't enough. It was that embrace of the what'd you say, the starving Christ? Is that what he?
The starved man on the cross.
The starved man on the cross. Exactly. So it was really, and I think the person he's, I think you compare him to in the book, the person who probably is the most comparable to him in 20th century is Mother Teresa, who had a very similar attitude, right?
Well, they did, but they were different. Father Al was extraordinarily, as we're talking about, Eric, extraordinarily bold. He feared nobody. At his funeral, the bishop, one of the bishops who eulogized him, said he didn't even fear God. The only thing he feared was sin. So Mother Teresa and Father Al, they sort of ran at the same time, sort of in the same circles. And Father Al prayed not to be known. And I often think that if Mother Teresa never came under the gaze of Malcolm Muggeridge, that right. She might be unknown. But where Mother, I'll tell you a story, a real quick story. So Father Al, in one of their encounters, went up to Mother Teresa, and again, very boldly. But he also had a wit and a humor to him. He said, "Mother, I'm going to buy you washing machines." And Mother, you know, all 4'7", looked up at him and squinted, and he said, "Mother, everybody already knows your sisters are humble. They should not be hand washing their sorries in the streets. They should be out in the streets working." So he blunted his boldness with a wink, and Mother got it. But where Mother would take sort of the dying man off the street and allow that man to die with dignity, Father Al said, "I will make sure that man is never there." So as a 7, 8, 9-year-old, Father Al would reach for the orphan and form them up. So they were very much alike, but they are also very different.
Very good. Okay, so now he goes to seminary in Europe, and everything goes peachy keen, no problems, right?
You read the book.
Yes, I did.
So for your listener, get this for boldness. So Father Al leaves the Marinolers and everyone in his family, including Sister Malfrida, said, "Dumbest mistake of your life. Idiotic." Everybody. No one gave him support. He's like, "Okay, whatever. I got to go." So he caught a boat. He's 4 months behind in the course load. The only languages spoke in Louvain were French and Latin. Didn't speak French. Latin he just knew from the Mass. And before the end of the semester, he's already passing by his classmates. So he's very smart too. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. And he became beloved by these Frenchmen, the Italians, the Irish, the Belgians, because he was this American cowboy. He was the only American there. And initially they saw him as, "Oh, you're too cocky and too hard for the Marinolers. You're going to come here and show off." So he had to earn sort of that trust. And he had this good nature to him. So all of a sudden the guys started to appreciate sort of his joy. He had a joy. Very, very carefree joy. The first 4 years of our first 3.5 years of seminary were good, and then it got rough for him.
Yeah, and it was amazing. And I admit I was thinking of today's issues with bishops and whatnot, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So right before his ordination, I mean, we're talking the same month of his ordination. And I believe his ordination was the Feast of St. Peter and Paul, which is this week.
Yesterday.
So it's a good timing here. He basically is ordered, basically says, you're done, right?
Yeah. It's simple as this. His rector, so Al, because he was he became a popular guy in the seminary by his fourth year, he was voted sort of the director of the student council. So if there was ever any gripes of the seminarians, the food was too cold, the chapel was too hot, whatever, the theology teacher was too difficult with his grading, well, Father Al was the one who would go to the rector. The rector had come out of 4 concentration camps. He had escaped, and he came back with, I guess, what you would call his PTSD, and he was famous for this temper throughout all of Belgium, really well known for this temper. So Father Al, he didn't care. He's like, "You know what? I need to do my job." So there was a huge friction between these two. And you're right, Eric. So a month before his ordination back in America, the first time he had been back in America in 4 years, a letter came in the mail to the Bishop of D.C. who was to ordain him, and to Father Al saying, "We're going to cut it off. Do not ordain this man. He's not the right stuff."
I can't even imagine that. You go through, how many total years would it have been? Would it have been 8 years of seminary?
13
years of seminary. You've wanted to be a priest since you were 7 or whatever it was. And you're literally going, you're in America, you're getting ready, you're probably making preparations with the family. Okay, we're going to have a party afterwards, we're going to do this, whatever. And then you get a letter from your rector saying, nope, we're pulling the plug. And one thing that came in was it at this point that they start, I think it was later, they start doing the obedience guilt trip, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So anyway, though, so he gets pulled, but obviously he became a priest because we're calling him Father Al. So just real quick, tell how he ended up, how that ended up working out for him, that he got ordained.
I'll try and make this quick. So he got the letter and, you know, I'd be on the ground weeping, but Father Al's like, well, you know what, Mary will handle this for me. He had a deep devotion to Mary. There's an apparition site in Belgium. He fell in love with Our Lady of Benno. So he said, I'll pray. Mary will work this out. I know my ordination is 13 days away, but he said, but I must cooperate. I must fight for my priesthood because Mary stuck it in my heart. So he begged and borrowed and took a flight back to Belgium, met with the Bishop of Belgium, of Louvain, and pled his cause. The bishop said, you need to become a priest. You're uncommon. You're holy. We want you. So he essentially, the bishop incarnated him, took him out of the Samus, that was the order of the Samus, and brought him in to Liège, his own diocese, and said, look, you're with me now. I want you on my team. So Father Al went back to America and was ordained on time.
I would have been maybe not on the ground crying. I would have been just probably screaming at people and being very upset. But he just said, Mary, you'll take care of me. And she did. So then he gets sent to as a missionary to Korea. And again, and now everything works out smoothly for him, right? And so he goes to Korea and he works. And this is after the Korean War. And so it just poverty just of a type that we Americans can't even imagine. And I think you did a good job of describing it. At one point I was at dinner with my wife and family and I wanted to say something about it. And I was like, I can't talk about this at the dinner table because it's disgusting. And there's no other word for it. The type of the life these people had to live. And he just dove right into it. And so then, but talk a little bit then about his struggles early on and his relationship with his bishop, because this is something I want to bring up later, is this relationship with his bishop, which at the beginning sounds great and everything works out. But what were his struggles early on in Korea and how did his bishop help him overcome it and what happened there?
Well, really, he got off the train on the Southern Peninsula on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception in 1957 and he saw a dystopian novel. He saw just ruination and whatever was grotesque with society, he saw it. You know, whenever there's war where over a million people die, Satan steps in and stokes even more evil and just things that are ugly. And this is what Father Al stepped into: orphans neglected on the streets, dying, gangs of lepers rubbing their diseased limbs up against people to steal their money. Just bad, bad stuff. And so he said, well, Mary, you've called me here to bring relief to the humiliated and the disregarded, but there's too many, so I must start somewhere. So he started with the orphan, and he began to build these boys' towns and girls' towns. And it's a long story, but the bishop at the time saw that this uncommon American priest was getting work done. He started an order of nuns called the Sisters of Mary, who were acting as sort of mothers to these abandoned kids. All the while, he's building hospitals. He's building hospices, elementary schools in the slums. He's just sort of rebuilding all of South Korea. And his old buddy, the bishop, Bishop Choi, he started to get into some of the money that Father Al was bringing in from American donors. And that's where things got pretty hot.
Yeah. And so I want to go back to that in a moment, because that's when we're going to talk about the challenges of being a heroic priest. But essentially though, so he is wildly successful in raising money, successful in building these boys and girls towns. I think a hospital or two, correct, as well. And he expands into the Philippines. And then I want to wrap up kind of his life story before we go back to some of his challenges with his bishop and with some others. So this is the 1980s now, and he comes down with ALS, which I can't remember what ALS stands for, but it's Lou Gehrig's disease. And so tell us a little bit about the end of his life and how he was heroic in that aspect of his life as well.
Well, again, he was a saint. So when he was diagnosed with ALS, he knew he had, you know, 3 more years. So he said, "Mary, you call me. You call me in a deeper way now. I don't have much time left. I must work harder." And this was a man who never took time off. He lived in a shack. He lived like a poor man. So he could pour himself out as a libation for the poor for 20, 25 years in the Philippines and Korea. So he felt in a certain sense that Mexico, Mary wanted him to go to Mexico on the other side of the world, because many of these Mexicans, because of the crushing poverty, were losing the Catholic faith. Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? Mm-hmm. Our Lady of Guadalupe was weeping because the Mexicans were leaving. A lot of them were coming evangelicals and Protestants or just leaving the Catholic faith altogether. And he said, "I must go. I feel called to go to Mexico." So he goes to Mexico with a cane, and the cane is traded to a wheelchair. And towards the end of his time there, he knew he was going to die here. Here's where he was going to disappear. He built that first girls' town, which became a boys' town. And the Sisters of Mary, this was his unfinished symphony. The Sisters of Mary said, "Don't worry, Father Al, we got it. We got your back. We saw how you lived poor. We saw how you took care of the poor. When you die, we will take over." And now today, there's over 20,000, this very day, there's over 20,000 children in boys' towns and girls' towns all over the world. Brazil, Tanzania, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Korea, Philippines. It's an astonishing story. And again, folks don't know about it because Father Al didn't want to be known. But I believe, Eric, in a certain sense, because these sisters take these battered kids into these authentically Catholic boys' towns and girls' towns, almost like pulling these Lazaruses from the tomb, 5 years later, they go out into universities and workplaces, and they're like shafts of light. They're like bright hallelujahs of Catholicism for this secularized world in 2021. And they don't know any better because they saw what the sisters did for them. Like, I know resurrection. I know what Lazarus felt. I had nothing from these poor towns of Mexico or wherever it is. The sisters built me back. They've re-engineered everything. So now I must show the world what the love of Christ feels like. So I believe, Eric, that what Father Al started way back in 57 and what the sisters are doing to this very day, I really believe this, I wouldn't say it if I didn't, is saving in a certain sense the Catholic Church, because it's re-catechizing folks that don't know anything about Christ or just who have abandoned the faith.
I mean, reading the book, I was just amazed, because I'm sure the vast majority of people who hear this book, the first thing they say after they see the title and the subtitle is, who? They've never heard of him. They've never heard of Father Al. I had never heard of him before. And I just read because you wrote it, and it was ended up being like, this guy is amazing. I mean, what he did is so unknown, but yet it's so amazing, which is, there's a beauty in that because he didn't want to be known. And so just for people who, that was the brief 20-minute overview of his life. Read the book. I'll put it up on the screen here. You already see it, but read the book to really learn more about Father Al. It's Ignatius Press, right? Ignatius Press. Yes, Ignatius Press. So get it from Ignatius Press. I'll put a link to the book in the show notes. But now I want to transition a little bit from his amazing life, because you have in the title The Heroic Life of Venerable Aloysius Schwartz. And I think there's a way that this ties in, because your previous book, one of your previous books, is The Priests We Need to Save the Church. Can you talk a little bit about the connection? Because in your mind, I think there's a connection between this book and the other book, and other people might not see that connection. What is the connection between these books?
Father Al is flesh on the bones of The Priests We Need to Save the Church.
Yeah.
And you can, it's multi-layered, it's multi-dimensional, but I think Father Al, if Father Al were alive today, and he should be, you know, Father Al was alive back when your Cincinnati Reds were a good baseball team in 92, you know, back when Michael Jordan was, you know, halfway through his career. Father Al was alive. He should be 90 today. And he was an athlete. He ran every day of his life. So he'd be one of these 90-year-olds that would looks like he's 65. But Father Al would look out in the landscape today and he would see a revolt, an absolute revolt against the Father's love and against truth. And he would have stepped into it. So why he was a hero back then and why he would have been a hero today is because all priests, like I think all priests today know what they've just encountered the past month with this societal understanding of what June and Pride Month is. They know how bad it is, but I would think the majority of priests and almost all bishops, they didn't step into it. Father Al was a hero because he always stepped into things. I guess the best way to say it, Eric, and I'll shut up here, is Father Al, it was very easy. It was like a three-pronged kaleidoscope, and it was always sort of spinning. If it's in the gospel, I do it. If the saints lived it, then I live it. And if Mary is calling me there, then I go. So he always kept it very simple. And if he saw this spiritual revolt against truth, then Father Al steps into it. He doesn't care what happens if he preaches on, the complementarity of the sexes or traditional marriage or whatever it is. He looked at that kaleidoscope and he said, it's time for me to act like a spiritual father.
And that is, I mean, we're so desperate to have models of heroic priests, because I think as lay people, to be honest, I think we've been beaten down a little bit on our expectations of priests. As long as they're not heretics, as long as they're not Father James Martin, okay. I mean, we're okay with them or something like that. But really what we need in this time of crisis, when Catholics are leaving the church at just horrendous rates, we need heroic priests. We need priests that go beyond just, okay, I'm going to celebrate the sacraments, maybe have a nice homily that nobody really gets offended by, and then go back to the rectory. We really need heroic priests. And one of the ways that, one of the difficulties, you know, this is crisis, so we can say these things. One of the difficulties is the bishops, for priests to be heroic, because we hear that again and again, where something like COVID, the COVID thing, when everything was shut down, all the restrictions, all the craziness, was priests, they couldn't do anything because their bishops wouldn't allow them to. Speak a bit, the part about Father Al in Korea with his bishop, let's talk about that now, because I felt like that was so applicable to today. So tell a little about, so we already heard that the bishop started helping himself to some of the funds. And what happened then when Father Al found out about that?
Well, Father Al cut him off. You know, Father Al said, you know, I started this organization to go to the humiliated, to the poor, and you're taking money and you're bilking it. You're giving it to priest friends. You're giving it to government officials. You're done. So the bishop was startled by Father Al's boldness. Father Al doesn't care because, again, gospel, saints, Mary. So the bishop began to calumniate him with other bishops in Korea and the Far East. Priests talked to priests poorly of Father Al. Father Al was saving his diocese, resurrecting the Catholic faith, introducing the Catholic faith, starting an order of nuns that were going to the least of these. But his bishop said, he's no good. He's a cowboy and he's dangerous. Stay away from him. So Father Al's a pariah. Father Al's saving his diocese, but Father Al's is considered a jerk. What does Father Al say? I don't care. Mary has put something in me. I'm going to keep going forward. So I think with in analogizing or looking at today's bishops, you know, it seems to me that they're, and again, we don't want to generalize because you and I are both friends with holy bishops, right? But there's a damming up of transcendence. There's a damming up of the fullness of the faith, the blazing furnace of the gospel that we know that it is, because bishops don't encourage. You're a Cincinnati Reds fan. The way I look at it is this. So you love Sparky Anderson at one point. It's like Dave Concepcion or Ray Knight or whomever, Johnny Bench, looking at Sparky Anderson and saying, hey, look, it's the World Series. We're a big red machine. And Sparky's out smoking a cigarette, drinking a beer. So, hey, guys, do well. So it's that leadership that I think these priests are looking for throughout COVID last year, whatever it is, and they saw a damning up. Shut your door, shut off the sacraments. Don't look to us to help you now, because we're paying attention to the governors. We're paying attention to a future lawsuit in case somebody gets COVID. So don't look to us right now. We're attached to other things. So the priests are left hanging. The big issue, I think, though, Eric, is Father Al would have seen this and he would have said, well, I'm going to obey God. I know people throw out the vow of obedience. I need to obey my formed conscience and God, because one day I'll be sitting across from him. So I will find a way to bring the starving lady the sacraments. I will find a way to leave maybe the back door of my church unlocked when I celebrate my private mass. And if someone filters in, oh, well.
Right.
So Father Al simply did not care if he saw in his bishop something corrupt, because he owed his allegiance to the Virgin Mary and to God.
Yeah, and that's what's amazing is this bishop, I mean, he wasn't even trying to hide that he was taking the money. He was just like, yeah, I'm the bishop. I can do it if I want to, because I think this is what's the best use of the funds. And they put him on the obedience guilt trip, which you see today so much, where if a priest goes even slightly out of line, then it somehow they're breaking their vow of obedience, which is become the end all be all, the only thing that matters. And yet Father Al, who is venerable and his cause for sainthood is being advanced, technically speaking, he broke it. I mean, he broke the in a way, because, I mean, he did have a certain, because that this bishop was who he, his superior, religious superior, but he simply just said, no, this is not what I'm going to do. And I think that's a certain heroism that we just don't see in priests today. And so what can, now, because I don't want to be, I mean, I know how difficult it is for priests. What can a priest do? I mean, what can they do to be heroic? I mean, it's kind of a tough question. But practically speaking, how can Father Al be a model for them in these real situations where their bishop tells them to do something or wants to, and they are like, I have to do what God wants me to do?
Well, there's no more helicoptering for lay Catholic laity or for priests. There's no more hovering. You're going to, I think in their deepest recesses, every priest understands who their bishop is. I mean, obviously we don't know the heart of any man, but by their fruits, we will know them, right? So a priest intensifies his prayer life and his fasting and his understanding of Mary, tell me what to do during these confusing times where this priest was just sent to the wilderness. This priest was relieved from his duties, because he is prophetic, because he did things during COVID that may be a little bit out of line. Mary, tell me what to do. So, Eric, the way I sort of see it, and especially after I wrote the book, The Priest We Need to Save the Church, I'd heard from several priests and bishops too, from around the country. And here's sort of the breakdown. I'm going to just throw it at you and tell me what you think. But I almost see it like four categories. And obviously you can't generalize, but here's how I think it breaks down. Like 5 to 7% of priests in the country want to be John Vianney. You know, every day they're waking up and say, how can I be a saint? They're at the hospital at 2:30 a.m. because someone needs them. They're praying in their office with intentionality, et cetera. The second tier, let's skip the second tier. Let's go to the third tier. The third tier of priests are like 5% that have fallen, but they're on the way back up. Maybe it's alcoholism or pornography or whatever, but they've been humiliated and they want to be a good priest again. Good on them. The fourth section of priests have no supernatural faith. Absolution in the box is just Catholic hocus pocus. They simply, in a certain sense, they do not believe. Let's go back to the second tier. That's about 70%, something like that. They never look down. They always look up at that first percent. And two things they say. Oh, Mr. Hotshot. Yeah, I heard he started a new ministry for the infertile and unwed mothers. And he's just taking another one on. Yeah, he's a superstar. He was at the hospital at 4 a.m. and then he went over to the other hospital across town, hotshot priest. That's what they might say to the brethren or think in their head. But really their conscience says, man, I wish I could be him.
Right.
I can't do it, though, because I'm too stinking comfortable in how I'm living out this priesthood. I think that the key to this place we're in right now of great chaos is that second tier, those 70%, breaking themselves as Father Al did and say, I will give all. Like the rich young man to Jesus saying, you know what? I don't care. Yes, Jesus, I will follow you. I will pick up my cross daily. If that 70% can be picked off one by one by one and encouraged by their laity, encouraged by their intentional laity, Father, I see greatness in you. Father, I pray for you. Father, I love you. But behind the ambos, sometimes I see a flat-footedness. I see a reluctance to preach on something that I know is on the tip of your tongue, but you don't do it because you fear blowback. Father, I can't be holy in a certain sense until you show me holiness. Father, I can't be courageous in a certain sense until you show me courage from behind the ambo. Father, please do this for your parish. You owe it to God. So I often look at that second category as taking that Father Al-like step and living radically, saying, I will not live. It's not a bachelorhood mentality, but it's kind of a comfortable, I've engineered right. my priesthood in a certain way, and I'm going to just stick it out for the next 20, 30, 40 years. That's no longer acceptable. Eric, as you said a few minutes ago, people are leaving the Catholic Church in droves.
Right.
Our church is on fire. So that's where I am.
Yeah, and I work for a diocese for 5 years and work very closely with all the priests and dioceses. And I would say your four tiers are exactly right. That's exactly what I experienced there with meeting lots of priests in lots of different parishes. And it is unfortunate because it's like one thing I want to say is that it's not that we're saying, for people who are listening, I don't want them to think we're saying priests should strive to be disobedient to their bishops. That's not what we're saying. The idea is that top tier, they're not thinking, oh, how can I be disobedient? They're thinking, how can I serve God? And that's their focus. And that's the number one thing, is taking care of the laity and their needs. And one thing that's also true, you know, we talk a lot about, especially after Vatican II, we talk about like the laity, and it's the laity that need to recover things and renewal. And I think that's true on a definite level. I've written that myself. But we're not Protestants. We need priests. We need good and holy priests. I don't know about you, but when I am in a parish with a priest, and I am fortunate to be in one right now with priests who really are if they're not in the top tier, they're knocking on that door trying to get into that top tier. That's it just makes such a difference in my life, my spiritual life. And I imagine, you know, obviously my wife and my kids, particularly, the influence is just immense. And the same thing is true when you're in a parish where the priest is in that second tier below. And if you're in a parish that your priest is in fourth tier, get out. Just find another parish. I mean, because you got nothing there. But I really think that this need for heroic priest, we're desperate for it. I mean, that we're begging for it as lay people. I mean, I'll get on my knees and beg for it. I mean, that's what we have to do. And I think that's what I want to ask you then. What can lay people do now I like what you said about confronting our priest and encouraging them, pushing them. What else can lay people do to really help us get more heroic priests?
Well, I'm kind of a nutter, but here's what just this past weekend, I met with two young priests that I think want to be holy, and I think they want to step in. There might be some reluctance that I've sensed, and this is just from friends and people telling me. So I said, let's get together. Let's talk. And I was very candid. It was frank talk about this is the identity of a priest. This is the burden of your identity. Are you doing this? Well, I'm kind of no. You this is what you took on. This you need to do. Well, it's I don't tell me it's tough. So I think frank but charitable talk, squaring your shoulders, looking the young priest in the eye, and saying, this is what the ladies starve for. Eric, you said you're on your knees begging. I'll beg too. Right. And what I do is, I've left your parish. I can go across the street. I can walk across the street to this parish in 7 minutes. But I travel every day for weekday mass or Sunday mass, 45 minutes. And I've wasted a lot of gas money with Joe Biden and president. But I passed your church because here's what I've experienced for years. You know, I help bring in That Man Is You or a men's group or a First Friday Holy Hour. And if the pastor and the associate pastor, if they're not involved, then it's going to wither. And it finally struck after 2018. And there was covering for McCarrick and there was no penitential act of, please, we beg for your forgiveness. The jig is up. You know that we knew about what he was doing. We didn't say anything. That's when I said, everything's got to change. Right. If you're not a holy priest, if you're not striving to get all the souls of your parish into heaven, get out of there. And Eric, you said it. So you and your wife and family are going to a parish now with a holy priest. You sense the moment you step into the threshold of that church of your parish, that this is holy grounds because mm-hmm. it is protected by a holy priest that fasts, that prays the office with intentionality, that is Marian, and that is Eucharistic. And you know it like that. It doesn't, you don't have to sniff it out. It just bombards you. And you said it, Eric, you also know it when you cross the threshold and you see a contraception of everything that's sacred. And you don't sniff it out. It just blows you over.
That's right. That's right. And when you walk into that parish with the holy priest, then you, if you're not living up to it, you feel like, okay, I need to live up to this. I mean, that's the beauty of holiness, is that it's a very attractive and it makes you want to change your life. You want to get to that confessional quick. You're not avoiding it. You're like, the priest does. I mean, the holy priest always preached the confession, but even if they didn't, you're like, I want to get there because this is the example it's being set for me.
Yeah. I'm selfish. I don't want to go to hell. I need a holy priest really to get, and I mean this. Right. Just like my older brother would do this when I was a kid, he'd get in my face. I do want a priest to say, Kevin, you're just not doing it right with your 18-year-old son, because here's what I saw or here's what I overheard. Here's the approach you should have had. And you know what? Pray on it, because you're not getting it done. Well, if I know this priest is holy and is after my soul, then I better at least think about changing and hopefully change with the cooperation with the Holy Spirit. Right. So yeah, I need to be led in my fallenness. I need to be led to something higher.
Right. Okay. We're going to wrap it up here in a second, but priests who are listening or watching, we're praying for you. Please be heroic. We're begging you. Real quick though, I do want to ask, what is the status of Father Al's cause for canonization?
Well, 2015, Pope Francis declared him of heroic virtue, so he's on the path. He's venerable, really, because Father Al prayed not to be known. No one knows him. And Ignatius, so you get in touch with Father Fessio, the president of Ignatius. He's like, what? I don't know this guy. Write his biography. So now the cat's out of the bag. You know, he's out of the seal has been broken. So it's this simple, Eric. He needs two miracles. So there's already dozens of miracles from around the country, from Philippines, Mexico, that have prayed for him and the sisters and kids. And I know these stories because I spent a month down in Chaco, Mexico, about these miraculous healings. However, as we all know, you know, there's got to be investigations, doctors, priests, bishops. So really, I encourage priests to tell your parishioners, especially if they have muscular diseases or ALS or something of the body, ask Father Al to intercede, because this man, you know, the Holy Spirit determines these things, but this man will be an American saint. He will be canonized. If you read Priest and Beggar and see what he did and the life he lived and how heroic and Marian it was, I find his life flabbergasting. He kicked me in the teeth when I was writing his book. Every day I'd be kicked in the teeth by his holiness. So I encourage the book to be read, but really he just needs a couple of miracles.
Very good. And is it Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. that's in charge of it since he was born there, or is it over in Korea or somewhere like that?
It's actually the Philippines.
It's the Philippines. Oh, that's right, because that's where he ended up passing away, right? It was Philippines. Yeah. Okay. So I recommend Priest and Beggar very highly. I read it. I loved it. I will say, I even realized there's some things I was being a little too comfortable, and I was like, okay, I need to start moving in the direction. I may not get to Father Al's level, but I got to be going in that direction. So I really appreciate it for myself as well. So where can people buy the book?
So a couple of things. Yeah, that's why that was the kick in the teeth for me. I'm like, man, I'm a clown show. I got to get this thing going.
that's me too.
I mean, give me a break. So number one, if you want to learn more about Father Al, please go to worldvillages.org. Support hit what he started in 57. That's the real story. So Priest and Beggar is one story. The real story is what the sisters are doing with these kids. They're taking the least of these, the humiliated, the physically, emotionally, and sexually abused, and bringing them in and healing them. Worldvillages.org. I mean, you know, give to those guys. They're helping to save the Catholic Church. Donate to them. As far as the book itself, Ignatius.com, you know, Barnes & Noble, your local Catholic bookstore. Don't go to Amazon. They screw everything up. But I would just go to Ignatius.com.
Yeah, I'm with you on the anti-Amazon kick. My wife and I are moving towards getting rid of our Amazon Prime, but we realized how much we're tied to it. It's like, oh my gosh, they're so good at like getting you. So, but eventually, okay. So I'll put a link in the show notes to the book and also to worldvillages.org. I'm glad you gave that, because I wasn't sure of that either. Where can people find what you're doing, what you're up to?
Well, let's go to kevinwells.org or thepriestweneed.com.
Wells done. Okay. I'm writing it down so I don't forget. So, okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you for everybody who is watching and listening. Again, I encourage you to buy the book. More importantly, I encourage you to encourage your priests to be heroic. If you are a priest, be heroic. If you're a lay person, encourage your priest to be heroic. Until next time, everybody, God love you.